From the rolling bluffs of the Driftless region to the pristine shorelines of Superior in Michigan, from the Northwoods to the Kettle Moraine, Civic Media broadcasts across all of Wisconsin.
For all of Wisconsin.
Take a trip with us across the radio network to hear from communities throughout the state. This is the Civic Media Spotlight.
Kicking off this weekend's Civic Media Spotlight, we head to Matinair On Air, where Jane and Greg were joined by Andrew Gurman, former president of the American Medical Association, to discuss the impacts a second Trump administration would have on healthcare and healthcare access across the country.
Good morning and welcome to Matinair On Air. Jane Matinair, Greg Bach, and Calvin Butenhoff coming to you from our studio in downtown Waukesha. You can always join the show. You can call, you can text at 855-75-CIVIC. Or leave a comment on the live stream on Facebook, YouTube, or what used to be Twitter. Very excited to have our next guest joining us. He is the former head of the American Medical Association. Andrew Gurman is here. Good morning, Andrew. Thank you so very much for joining us.
Good morning. It's my pleasure.
Andrew, I wanted to read a little portion of this. You are among a number of healthcare leaders who came out with a letter to the American public last week. And I just want to read just a little bit of this letter that you, along with many, many others, released last week. We write today as people who have dedicated our lives to helping people. As the former leaders of national healthcare organizations, we have come to understand how policy impacts public health, and just as importantly, the ability of American families to afford the healthcare they need. The possibility of Americans not getting essential healthcare, either because of the cost or lack of access, is among our greatest worries. If he is elected president again, Donald Trump will make our fears a reality. The price of health care for American families under Trump would skyrocket. Millions would lose access to health care altogether. While his specific policies are at best ambiguous, his track record and words make clear the damage he would do. Was that a difficult decision for you to make, Andrew, to sign on to this letter along with these other health care professionals?
Yeah, it was a very difficult decision. I mean, I've not been particularly active politically throughout my life. I've advocated forcefully on behalf of patients and physicians, including when I was president of the American Medical Association. And I guess I should state for the record that I am not speaking on behalf of the AMA. I'm speaking on behalf of myself. But I'm very concerned. I'm concerned about what happened during the first Trump presidency. And I'm concerned about what the possibility is for what's going forward. A number of the people who are co-signatories on this letter are experts in security matters, in other areas. I don't have any expertise in that, but they asked me if I would be interested in helping them out in the area of health policy, which is something I do know a little bit about. So I started the process that ended up in that letter, which was signed by 48 people, and people can go online and find the list. It's a pretty heady bunch to be part of.
Absolutely, and we will include this in our show notes after the show is over. So if you go to civicmedia.us and you just go to shows, click on Matinair On Air, and that will take you to all of our shows,
all of our episodes.
They're an hour apiece. And it's really well broken down. But then we have show notes in there with links to these articles. So just so people remember, in the first 2 years of the Trump administration, they had all three branches. They had the House, the Senate, and the White House. And Donald Trump said at that time, we're going to repeal and replace Obamacare with something great. That never happened.
That's correct. The first thing he did was he sued to try to get it declared illegal. That suit was unsuccessful. And then he tried to repeal it. And it failed by one vote in the Senate. God bless you, Senator McCain.
John McCain, yep. Yeah.
Oh, the thumbs down, wasn't
yep.
it? It was the...
Yep, it was the thumbs down.
2:30 in the morning, something like that. But the fact is that they didn't have anything to replace it. And Mr. Trump on the campaign trail, this time for 2 years, talked about how he was going to repeal it. And now he's going to replace it with something much better. But there have not been any particulars about how it's going to be made better.
What has the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare, because they're the same thing, what has this done for the American people?
Well, it did several things. The biggest thing that it did was it expanded access through what are now called the Obamacare plans, the exchanges. But it provided an access for people to get insurance who otherwise wouldn't qualify. It also called for and enabled an extension of Medicaid, although states had to decide whether or not to do that. Some states did, some states didn't. The data are pretty clear that the states that didn't had worse health outcomes than those that did. Look, it's really very simple. People who don't have insurance, regardless of what the insurance is, people who don't have insurance live sicker and die younger. Those facts are incontrovertible. Because what happens is, and I'll use diabetes for an example, people who have diabetes and don't have access to health insurance or health care can't access a nurse diabetic educator or a clinician or a physician to be monitoring things like their hemoglobin A1C, which is an important blood test to see how your blood sugar levels are doing over time. So what happens is they simply ignore it because they don't have access, and then they get into trouble. They get into trouble because they go into what's called ketoacidosis, which is when your diabetes is totally out of control. Or they start showing the late effects of diabetes, which includes problems with your blood vessels. So they present to the emergency room with foot ulcers or infections or whatever, and they end up with amputations. Or even if they don't get that far, if they present in ketoacidosis, the emergency room can fix that. They can give you intravenous and drugs and some insulin and, you know, to get you out of that. But you go home and you still don't have access to a diabetic nurse educator or a clinician or the labs or good food or whatever.
You're going to be right back where you were, right?
That's exactly right. Yeah. So it is more expensive, and people just live sicker and die younger. The Affordable Care Act provided access for those people.
Andrew Gurman is our guest. He is a former president of the American Medical Association, and he is one of 48 physicians and experts in the medical field who have signed on a letter to the American public about the threat a second Trump administration would have on our healthcare system. In this letter, it says the Trump administration supported expanding short-term insurance, which discriminates against sicker people and those with pre-existing conditions. Also, the ACA's premium subsidies will expire next year. So the next president will have the chance to implement major changes. Given his opposition to these subsidies in the past, we can only assume that they will be limited under a second Trump administration. So if you are covered under Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act right now, that could drastically change next year and not necessarily for the better.
There's two quick points I'd like to make if we have time.
Absolutely.
I have no idea what your time schedule is. The first is sort of one of the reasons that I wanted to be involved in this letter. My grandmother used to say, if you have your health, you have everything. And if you don't have your health, you have nothing.
Yep.
And this letter is an attempt to go out to the American people on behalf of people who, like we said in the letter, have spent our lives doing this. It doesn't matter what your politics are. It doesn't matter what your policy views are. You can disagree on the economy, on the border, on anything you want. But our concern is that if Trump gets back into the White House, that there will be drastic effects on your health. And we wanted people to know that. The second point I'd like to make, which is in the letter, but most people don't ask me about it. And that is the statements that Trump has been making regarding gutting the institutions of the federal government. People have talked mostly about justice and some of the other departments. But I think one of the things that scares me most is the possibility that institutions like the National Institutes of Health, the FDA, and the CDC will be brought under the political control of the White House as opposed to function as independent agencies. Trump fought with Dr. Fauci throughout most of the COVID epidemic, as well as the director of the CDC and other experts who he just didn't want to, it wasn't convenient for him to listen to. I want to tell you a story about a drug called thalidomide. I don't know whether most people have heard about it.
Yes.
Thalidomide was a drug that was marketed in Germany in the 1950s as a treatment for the nausea associated with pregnancy, morning sickness, if you will. And it was brought to the FDA to be marketed in the United States. And the FDA said, we do not have enough safety data to allow this to be marketed here. No. And it turned out that within a year or two, we started seeing people born with horrible birth defects, small hands attached to shoulders with no arm in between, small legs, whatever. And it was all due to the thalidomide. These are people who will live, some of them are still alive, will live a long time with these lifelong deformities, disabilities. And it was the FDA that protected us against that. If the FDA is not free to offer that kind of independent advice, even if it's not necessarily convenient or wanted, I think that puts all Americans' health at risk. And that really scares me.
It should scare everyone, Andrew. It really should. We have talked several times about Project 2025 and what that would do and how essentially it does do away with the National Health Services and National Institute of Health. And also the possibility then where the administration comes to this organization, to this health organization, and says, these are the results we want. Now, do a study to back that up. Not do a study on this thing and see where that leads you and what the results are, which is the normal procedure, correct? They're going to do things backward and say, this is the answer that we want. Now make it so. And make up the data to make it so.
I don't know that to be true, but my worry is that data or results which are inconvenient will simply not be publicized, or studies which might prove to be inconvenient, again, if it's under the political control of the executive branch, that they'll simply be told, don't do the study.
Yeah.
We're going to continue this conversation. Andrew Gurman is here, a former president of the American Medical Association. Stay close. You're listening to Matt Nair on Air. This is the Civic Media Radio Network.
And she starts to cry. She takes a swing, man. She can't hurt. She don't mean no harm. She just don't know what else to do about it.
Matt Nair on Air is part of the Civic Media Radio Network and airs across the network weekday mornings from 10 till noon. To learn more about this show and all of the Civic Media programming, check out the website at civicmedia.us/shows.
Welcome back to Civic Media Spotlight. We now head to Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow, where Pat shares his thoughts on why the last few months of a gerrymandered legislature could explain the events surrounding the Wisconsin Capitol this week.
On this day in 1975, Fleetwood Mac played a concert in El Paso, Texas. The band had been around for quite a while, but this was their first concert with brand new members Lindsey Buckingham and Stevie Nicks. It worked out pretty well for them. Rhiannon here from Stevie Nicks, that was one of their first monster hits after she joined the band. More in today's history lesson coming up in just a bit. Here's another history lesson, Greg. Brewers relievers who went to San Diego. I'll take Josh Hader, please. Hader.
I thought you said the minors. You said they sent him down on the minors. I heard that for some reason. And then I typed in Texas for some reason.
Oh.
I'm so tired, Pat.
It's been a week. Lemon, yeah, it's Wednesday.
It's Wednesday.
855-75-CIVIC is the number. 855-75-CIVIC. You can call it. You can text it. You can use the Civic Media app as well to reach out to us. So the Wisconsin legislature, state Senate, had a meeting yesterday. They were in session, but as promised and as previewed here, they did not release the money for contaminated drinking water. Instead, it was all a political stunt designed to hold a vote to override some of Governor Evers' vetoes of some of their bills seeking to micromanage the executive branch. And then they had the audacity to get on their high horse and make it sound as if it's you know, the governor who shouldn't have veto power. Now, if you don't think that a president or a governor should have a veto, then, well, maybe you should get an amendment going through the, you know, through the legislature and then to the voters and see about getting rid of that whole system of checks and balances, if that's what works for you. But right now, governors do have the power of the veto. So you can pass a bill. It might get vetoed in its entirety, or here in Wisconsin, it might be vetoed, you know, in just some parts of it. And a governor has to give you a reason. And this governor did give a reason for the vetoes that he made to a couple of key bills. One of them was the money to clean up contaminated water in Wisconsin. And again, bear in mind, the bills that were vetoed were not necessary because the money is already in the state budget. The legislature already approved the money. I cannot emphasize that enough. But then the legislature set up this rule for themselves that says, well, we don't actually release the money unless this committee, the Joint Finance Committee, says so, and we can micromanage how that money has to be spent, which is just not something you see anyplace else and frankly didn't see very much of in Wisconsin as well. It goes to those various agencies, Department of Transportation, Department of Natural Resources, you know, whatever the case may be. They get the allocation and then the people who actually work in those fields make the determination to spend money that's in the budget. So there's this budget line to clean up PFAS, industrial chemicals in drinking water, and to go after the polluters. Well, Republican legislators passed a second bill, one that was not necessary, that said, hey, by the way, for that money that we already approved, we don't want the DNR going after the people who put the chemicals there. We'd rather side with industry. So please sign this bill, Governor, so that the DNR does not go after the polluters. Under the guise of protecting innocent landowners whose land got dumped on, when those safeguards already exist. But what they're looking to do is take away the language and the ability to go after industrial polluters. Needless to say, the governor vetoed that bill and said, guys, you already passed the money. You approved the money. Let's get the money out to clean up the water. And Republican legislators, again, got on their high horse and said, nope, the water can stay contaminated unless you let us override your veto. But again, governors have vetoes. If you don't like it, get a new governor. But you tried that already. And the voters said, we don't want Scott Walker anymore, and we don't want Tim Michaels anymore. We want this guy as governor in part because he's going to be a check and balance on you. And then there was the bill to allocate some funds to the Chippewa Valley to deal with two different hospital closures. Again, I won't go into all the details on that one, but again, the governor's veto provided more flexibility. The original allocation of money said, well, it's got to be used for ERs in Eau Claire and Chippewa counties. And the governor's veto allowed it to be used for other things like, you know, obstetrical services and in other places because the hospital closure is also affecting people in Dunn County and Clark County and Barron County. And Republicans, again, have the gall to call that a slush fund because heaven forbid folks in Dunn County or Barron County are also assisted during this medical crisis. And I would single out particularly the state senator from the area who sits in the seat that I had occupied a long time ago, Jesse James, who again could have been more of a bipartisan force to stand with other Chippewa Valley lawmakers and say, guys, this is not a slush fund. This is to help the people in my area. Let's release this. And instead, he plays along with the Republican Party's games that would rather have contaminated water and money not used for health care in his district, sending a bill that they did not even consult Democratic Chippewa Valley lawmakers on. They want so much to have a my way or the highway approach, and the temper tantrum, the way they are stamping their little feet when they can't get their way 100% of the time, is absolutely childish. And then it got more childish While they were debating the hospital bill for the Chippewa Valley, Republicans abruptly ended the session, called for the vote, said, "We're done. We're done." State Senator Jeff Smith, a Democrat from the Chippewa Valley, was livid, trying to, again, make the argument why they should not be overriding, attempting to override the governor's veto, and just gets cut off as he's trying to make the case to the Senate president. And we discover later that the reason they cut off debate was not so much that they were just tired and wanted to go home, although that could have been an easy reason with this bunch, but one of their members had to catch a flight, is what the Senate Republican leader told a reporter for WisPolitics. And of course, if one of the Republicans had left, well, then they'd no longer have enough votes to override a veto, which wasn't going to work anyway, because in the assembly, Republicans don't have the votes to override a veto. So they didn't really have to cut off the session. They didn't really have to appear, shall we say, jerk-like about it, but they didn't really have any problem going there. They didn't have any problem putting out press releases afterwards saying, "Oh, well, this is the governor's fault that, you know, we gave him, you know, that he's allowed to have a veto." That's not how it works. And it's the audacity and it's the arrogance that comes with gerrymandered maps, which thankfully for many Wisconsin voters is going to end this November. Melissa Baldoff has this week's climate check. Coming up next, you're up north. I'm Pat Kreitlow.
Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow is affiliated with the Civic Media Radio Network and airs on select Civic Media stations weekday mornings from 6 until 8. To learn more about this show and all of the Civic Media programming, check out the website at civicmedia.us/shows.
You're listening to Civic Media Spotlight. We now head to the Todd Alba Show, where Todd was joined by friend of the show, Trygve Olsen, to discuss some of the not-so-sexy facts surrounding the impacts of the Biden administration's infrastructure bill in Wisconsin and around the nation.
Whether you're on the shores of Lake Superior, all the way over to the shores of Lake Michigan, perhaps in the Driftless, or in the heart of the Green Bay Packers, welcome into the Todd Alba Show on the Civic Media Radio Network across the state of Wisconsin on broadcast radio and around the world on the Civic Media app. If you don't have it, download it today on either your Apple or Android device, the Civic Media app. It's free. It's easy, just like Todd. No, I'm not sure what that even means. We welcome in our friend and ongoing contributor, Mr. Trygve Olsen, like myself, a Wisconsin boy, like me, a former Republican, now senior advisor at the Lincoln Project. Trygve, always great to have you along. It's been announced this morning that President Biden and former President Donald Trump will go head-to-head in presidential debates on June 27th and September 10th, with the two White House hopefuls accepting invitations from CNN and ABC News to participate in events after a flurry of activity on Wednesday. And also just breaking here in the last minute or so, Brian Stetler, a great author of All Things News and Entertainment, says ABC's press release about the Biden-Trump debate says ABC News will make the debate available to simulcast on additional broadcast and streaming networks in America. It appears, Trygve, that there will be at least a couple of presidential debates this year.
Yeah, which is kind of interesting that the RNC had pulled out of the Presidential Debate Commission. I didn't see anything. I don't know if the campaigns agreed through the networks to do these independently. If the Presidential Debate Commission is in the middle of it, it does appear that. You know, I don't know. I have mixed feelings about that process side of things. Having gone through primary presidential debates in 2012, I think there were like 38 of them. And I have to say, I mean, it's fun traveling to Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina once, and Florida. But it's not so great to travel there 38 times or whatever it was. And but I mean, it's good that Americans are going to get a chance to see the two of them head to head. You know, it will be interesting to see how that plays out.
go to the phone lines. And Matt, listening in on WMDX here in Madison. Matt from Middleton, we appreciate you listening. Matt, what say you?
Hey, guys. I had a thought here and an idea that I want your opinions on about the debate. But it also has to do with Russia and the idea that Putin is selling and believes, which is fundamentally that humans are flawed, things are always bad and always will be, so you might as well have an autocrat that will at least give you bread, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that Biden should look across at Trump during a debate and challenge him to answer honestly and forthright what makes America great, because he talks about it all the time. And we know that the America he thinks is great was the 1950s, when all these marginalized communities had no power, no voice, and were kind of stuck in the shadows, whatnot. And I think it would be a big fumble for Trump. I think it would be a win for Biden, because he'd be put on the spot, and he's not intelligent enough to lie in a good way, so to speak. So I'm wondering what you think about that, if he would really fumble that and it would be good for Biden. Thanks.
You know, I do think, you know, I don't know what Trump would say if he was asked what makes America great. I'm not sure that he would talk about the 1950s, and maybe that's what they're clamoring for. Quite honestly, I don't think that most of the so-called right really knows what it is that has traditionally made America great, right? Like, you know, it's the fact that we didn't, after World War II, occupy countries, that we built countries based on, rebuilt them while the Soviets were occupying countries, and that the history of humanity had been to do that. Those are the things that made America exceptional. Donald Trump, you know, what makes America great for Donald Trump, I think, is anything that's beneficial to Donald Trump. Can he answer that question? Maybe he can give some kind of answer that his base would like. I think, you know, Joe Biden could answer the question, what makes America great? And you know, part of the reason Todd and I went on our little tour of Wisconsin and called it what makes Wisconsin great was to point out there are a lot of things that make Wisconsin great. There's a lot of things that make America great.
Yeah, and we'll give people a nugget here, Trigvy. We're still working on all the final details, but it appears that Trigvy and I will be hitting the road once again coming up in July across the state of Wisconsin, another 5-city tour. So stay tuned on the final details. But we're going to do her again, Trigvy.
We got some big ideas.
Yeah,
with things that make Wisconsin great. There's so many of them, you know. Like I, you know, as you and I were having that conversation, I probably thought of 3 or 4 other things, right? Mm-hmm. Like we could go muskie fishing in Hayward.
Right? How about that?
On the Lac de Flambeau.
Yeah.
You ever caught a muskie, Todd?
I never have. Have you?
I have never caught a muskie either.
Well, maybe this is our time.
I've caught a lot of fish in my life, but I have never caught a muskie.
Nope. Well, I think it'll be great because, of course, we got the RNC coming up, Republican National Convention in Milwaukee. And we thought, well, what the heck? Because we're going to hear a lot to the caller's point about what's wrong. We thought, well, why don't we just go around the state again and talk about all the things that are going well? And that was, you know, we're already great. We don't need Trump and Trumpism to make us great. We're already great because of Wisconsinites. So that'll be fun.
Wisconsin is great.
Yeah.
15,000 lakes, every one of them has fish in them, Todd.
Thank you so very much, Tommy George. off the text line, listening on WAUK, the Shaw, Jeff from Shorewood has a question for Trigvy. This is a good one because Trigvy has been part of preparing candidates for presidential debates. So here's one for you, Trigvy. Does Trigvy think it would be wise for Joe Biden to address his stuttering problem and deal with it at the beginning of debate? He could apply his issues to others with the same issue, unquote. Good question.
I don't know that I would say lead with it, but I think alluding to that, those kinds of challenges that are personal that candidates have gone through is always an important thing. I mean, one of the things I really respect about Joe Biden, having lost a child myself, is how well he talks about that being in the public eye. You know, those are hard wounds. They're there forever. You know, our daughter would have been a senior in high school this year. It's a little weird seeing graduation things. But that said, what Joe Biden also talks about is, you know, you gain some perspective on that. And I know that we probably wouldn't have my younger daughter. And so, well, I don't know why God didn't want me to have an older daughter. I know why he wanted me to have Gaia. And Joe Biden talks about those things in a very good way, in a way that's not about him. Whereas if you notice, everything Donald Trump, and if I were the Trump team, I'd be worried about this. Everything Donald Trump talks about is Trump.
Right. Well, I as someone myself born with a cleft palate and cleft lip and had all kinds of speech surgeries or surgeries on that, and a lot of therapy and a lot of great people that helped me through that, and eventually ended up at a job in radio against all odds, of course. And so I relate to that empathy. And I think that's one of Biden's strongest suits. And I know people, in fact, I just talked to a friend of mine who still, I think, considers himself a Republican, but not a Trump person, and said, well, you know, I really think that some of this stuff shows that Biden is declining. And then we had a good discussion, and I pointed out, look, do you realize, you know, that he has to think every time he's in front of a camera or behind a microphone, he literally has to work at not stuttering. So sometimes when he stops and uses a different word, and it looks like some people think that he's forgotten something, it's just him using a different word so that he doesn't stutter, because he doesn't want that image out there for campaign purposes. And after we thought, he goes, yeah, you know, you're absolutely right about that. So I think it's a good thing just to remind people, not to to campaign on it, but to say, look, you know, this is something that I've struggled with, but so do a lot of Americans. And then tell a story about one of these many young people that he still keeps in contact with to be a mentor about that. I think that'd be a cool thing.
Yeah, I mean, one of the most powerful pieces of video was him with a young man who wanted to meet him on the rope line, who had a stuttering issue and was being bullied at school. And honestly, it'd bring you to tears because, you know, he was not talking as president of the United States, and he paused and he literally asked his body guy, the guy standing next to him, to get the kid's phone number so he could call in and check in on him once in a while. And I saw a video later with the dad that he had occasionally gotten calls from the president, his kid had gotten calls from the president of the United States asking him how he was doing with his working on the problem.
I love the empathy. And as, again, I think it's one of Biden's really strong suits. 855-752-4842, 855-752-4842. I want to get to this. I think it's important. This is a cut from ABC News, George Stephanopoulos interviewing a former White House Situation Room officer, Mike Stigler, as he reveals what actually happened on January 6th. It's a couple of minutes long. Hang in there. We're going to get Trigvi's take on it on the other side. This is from ABC News with George Stephanopoulos.
I want to talk about January 6th. You were the duty officer that day.
Correct.
On the morning of January 6th, 2021, Stigler headed to the White House to start his usual 5 a.m. shift. Later that day, the riot erupted at the Capitol. At what point did you know that the Capitol had been breached?
As soon as it was called out on the radio. We thought somebody breached the gate or somebody breached a barrier. So when they called out that the Capitol was breached, at first we didn't know what that meant. At the time too, the vice president was there. And one of the responsibilities of the Situation Room is to always maintain communication with the president and the vice president. So those were the initial conversations of, okay, where is he? How can we locate him? You know, how do we maintain that communication link?
You told me people didn't understand how close we came to losing the vice president. What's going through your mind when you are hearing that the vice president's life may be in danger?
We started having the conversations. Okay, if VP's down, what's next? What do we got to do? How do we keep moving? Where's the second in line?
It's kind of remarkable, and you know what you're describing there is that you started to implement and go through the checklist of
the Situation Room did,
the Situation Room,
correct,
of what is called the continuity of government procedures. Describe what those are.
Those are originally instituted for if there's an attack on the U.S. government, how does the government, especially the executive branch, keep going? So that means line of succession, that means how do we move to different locations, and how do we keep the government going
during a riot of our own people, inspired by the man sitting upstairs.
Correct. But at the time, that's not even in the forefront of our mind. It doesn't matter how we got here. We're here. How do we execute? How do we move forward?
Did the president ever call down to the Situation Room that day?
Not to my knowledge.
Not once?
No, sir.
Didn't ask what was going on.
Not to my knowledge.
Didn't ask how the vice president's doing.
Not to my knowledge.
Some people even questioned the elected officials whether the vice president was really in danger. You see a lot of revisionist history going on about January 6th. As someone who was inside the room that day, what's your reaction?
It's important to me that we don't forget that it did come that close, and that we did have discussions. If we lose the VP, if the 25th is invoked, we start running through all of these game plans because it was getting close.
Trevi Olson from ABC News there, George Stephanopoulos, interviewing one of the key people in the White House Situation Room on January 6th. I thought that was a powerful interview and a powerful thing to listen to.
Yeah, incredibly powerful. I mean, I think we forget, because we live in an age of such rapidly happening news and how much news is available to people. But I would go so far as to say, you know, I truly believe that what we saw on January 6th was and should be, but it probably isn't, the most consequential thing that happened in American history since maybe Truman's decision to drop an atomic bomb on Japan, or maybe Pearl Harbor.
Mm-hmm.
It was that big a deal. And in some ways, quite honestly, bigger deal because, you know, maybe Pearl Harbor, because the United States was at risk of having a coup.
And I think it's more powerful.
Or a bloodbath of politicians being murdered in the House of the People.
In my opinion, it's more powerful because, unlike those other examples you cited, instead of coming from the outside adversaries, it came from within the United States of America, as they pointed out, propagated, started by the, quote, the person upstairs at the time, President Trump. Come back with more of your phone calls and Trigvi as well. 855-752-4842. 855-752-4842. Back on the All Ball Show on the Civic Media Radio Network.
The Todd Alba Show is part of the Civic Media Radio Network and airs across the network weekdays from noon till 2. To learn more about this show and all of the Civic Media programming, check out the website at civicmedia.us/shows.
We round out this hour of Civic Media Spotlight with a segment from Busted Pencils, where Dr. Tim and Dr. Johnny have a discussion around AI in the classroom with Aaron McKelkey.
Ah, Busted Pencils, fully leaded education talk, educated educators talking education, talking AI education tonight. Yeah, you know, if you want to jump in, we had some texts, we'll call her though. The number's 855-752-4842. You're a teacher, AI, are you using it? If you are, how are you using it? If you are on that side of going, I don't want people using it, give us a call too. We'd love to hear from you. I mean, tell us about the realities of why we should think very deeply about whether or not students even should be using this. And again, you know, yeah, Johnny and Tim, we're always playing like Tim's the pro AI guy, Johnny's the anti-AI guy. We're really educated educators talking about AI education, making sure that we say, because you guess what? It's like a lot of things. It's a tool, and yeah, it can be used to do horrible things, and it can be used to do some amazing things. Johnny, when I hear Aaron talking about, again, the IEP, so a student with an individual education plan, so that special education student, he's got a co-special education teacher with him in his history class. Yeah, talking about, you know, presenting the kids a medieval text for seniors, juniors and seniors in high school. Heck, even for anybody, reading that is really hard reading. So the reality then, though, too, say to a student with special needs, using the tool to take that text and to level it down to the ability so that now the student, I love what Aaron was talking about, the student now just uses that tool to help them engage in texts.
Yeah, Tim, and it doesn't replace or change anything. It just makes space for more meaningful engagement. And I'll give, you know, kind of building on that same sort of example, that's not even for the student with the IEP.
Right.
It's just, that's an empowering example. It's for all the students. You know, this is not that different than, you know, when I was teaching social studies, we went to a special training around reading apprenticeship, and it was great. Kind of taught us how to break down difficult readings for our students to kind of look at them differently, change the format of them, teach them how to pull out a main sentence, you know, highlight critical questions that they have from the reading. So you're still doing that with this really powerful tool that you can also be fact checking. Be like, hey, we talked about good prompts for AI, bad prompts for AI. What did AI generate for you based on this article or based on this reading that we looked at together this week? And we can see and we can sort of evaluate and question our sources and determine together, right, with consensus, hey, was this good, meaningful information that we can take with us? Mm. Or, you know, or was it, did it fall short, did it have some gaps? That process alone,
right,
is really engaging and really about right. learning. So, I mean, we tease like you're for it, I'm against it. You know, I think I'm 100% for it as a tool.
Right.
And I'm against the world is changing and it's replacing us. And there's these Terminator, you know, we're headed towards these Terminator machines that are going to end all teaching, you know, and end all professions, just robots doing everything and people sitting at home. You know, it's like, okay, we've watched The Matrix too many times or other movies that, you know, that gets played out. You know, Aaron shared it with us. It only knows as much as it's told. Mm-hmm. And so as we engage with these, you know, these tools and these plugins, I think our caller Catherine said this too, like as educators, we need to be really, you know, engaged with this tool. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine that there's a math teacher out there that doesn't interact with calculators these days.
Right.
Is, you know, similar. There are writers who choose to only work on a typewriter.
Right.
You know, there are musicians who do everything all analog still, but there's some balance in between. You go into a studio and there's all kinds of tools and computers that help make music. It doesn't take the musicians out of it, you know? And so like, let's stop with the scary stuff. We're like, oh, AI is going to replace everybody. And, you know, and the students are cheating. They're actually not cheating. Teach them how to use this powerful tool.
It's like Martin. It was like Martin said though too. Martin Atkins, our guest the drummer. You know, it will eliminate bad drumming, like Martin said. And guess what? If you're a crappy teacher, yeah, maybe it is coming for your job. But you know what? Stop being a crappy teacher. Use the tool. It's Busted Pencils. The number is 855-752-4842. We just had a guest, Aaron McKelkey. We'll have a link for the podcast so you can check out all of his stuff. And in fact, you know, you can even sign up for one of Aaron's courses if you want to get yourself in front of, well, you can't get in front of AI at this point right now. We're all playing some form of catch up by going after this because it truly changes every day. Johnny, I got to tell you though, one of the things that's happening, you say about using it, right, and using it as a tool. I can tell you that in my house now, my wife and I will typically start to do the, you know, we're having a conversation. We're thinking, what do you think? What do you think? And then we're going, I wonder what AI thinks. We've actually started. I know, but because it's like, okay, I want to figure out whether or not I should, you know, say something in a certain way. I tell you what, as an email generating idea tool right now, I almost use it exclusively to say, I need to write an email to Johnny Lupinacci. It needs to talk about this. Give me a 3-sentence email to Johnny that's quick. And it's just the way it's become a tool now that I'm using it in that direction because it is better at making sure that I don't say something stupid.
Well, that's good, Tim. I mean, that's great. I'm still skeptical on that front. And I like that it works for you. I'm still like, that sounds like so much more work than me just typing up my email to Tim or my email to, you know, my colleague or whoever. So, I mean, I'm always open-minded about it, but I'm still going to dig in a little bit and be like, for me, it's quicker. You know what else is quick, Tim? Is if you're in Madison, heading down to the Minocqua Brewing Company. And why would you head down to the Minocqua Brewing Company?
Because Busted Pencils is sponsored by the Minocqua Brewing Company, who sued the state of Wisconsin to end its parasitic voucher system that hurts public schools. Minocqua Brewing Company is making Wisconsin great again, one beer at a time. Check out MinocquaBrewingCompany.com to see where you can buy their progressive beers. And while you're there, take your phone with you, download one of the latest AI tools. Hey, and if there's no one there at the bar to talk to your AI, have a conversation with it, Johnny, because that is, though, the reality, too, is we're using AI is that I see a lot of people's skepticism, and Aaron talked about this, going and it's either they haven't used it or they've used it one time, and they used it one time and they kind of didn't really realize that actually it's a dialogue machine. You really need to have a dialogue with this to really get it to work. And so when you're talking about prompting, it likes context. It likes details. It likes for you to say, hey, I didn't really like it that way. Tell me a little bit more. Busted Pencils. Hey, tomorrow night, Friday night, wrapping it up. Busted Pencils. Thanks for a great night, everybody. See you tomorrow.
Busted Pencils is part of the Civic Media Radio Network and airs across the network weekday evenings at 6 p.m. To learn more about this show and all of Civic Media's programming, check out the website at civicmedia.us/shows.